Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait a minute, that's not the Brian Lehrer Show theme. That's the Good News Stock Exchange music from the public radio program Marketplace. Well, good news is the quick media response so far to the unemployment rate suddenly dropping in October down to 8.6%. That's why we're playing this music. It's the best showing in 2.5 years. But wait a minute. Only 120,000 jobs were created. Not that good. The rate came down so much because more than 300,000 people gave up even looking for work, so they are no longer technically unemployed. So the news is really mixed. Oh, that's better, the Marketplace mixed market music. And with us to talk about these interesting new figures and more is Heidi Moore, New York Bureau Chief for Marketplace, who starts us off today unpacking a pretty dramatic week in economic news. Happy Friday, Heidi.
Thank you. Happy Friday, and may I compliment your DJing skills.
Yes. Well, you know, lots of years behind the turntables before the era of scratch. Maybe this is the day everyone wakes up, though, and finally says, the measuring system we use for the unemployment rate is for the birds. Should that really be the headline here?
Yeah, the birds wouldn't even use it to make their nests. I mean, we do have serious problems in how we measure unemployment, how we read unemployment, and what the unemployment numbers tell us. You hit on it almost exactly, right? So we have this like really fancy, amazing looking number that the unemployment rate has fallen to 8.6%. Now, that's got to get your heart pumping, right? If you're an American, you're thinking maybe things are getting better. But what that really means,
if you're President Obama's campaign manager, you're thinking, woohoo!
Right. You're over the moon. Right. And so but what it really means, unfortunately, is that 315,000 people just gave up looking for work. So they're not even counted anymore. And that's why the unemployment rate fell, because we're not actually counting everyone who is truly unemployed. We are counting people who were employed and now are not. And so that's a very limited definition of what's going on in the economy. And it contrasts, as you can tell, with what people see around them, you know. And one of the things we saw in today's report as well was that the people who are out of work for much longer periods of time. So there are 2 million people now who've been out of work for 99 weeks or longer, and that's 2 years. And the average unemployment length of time now is 40 weeks, right? So that's nearly a year, right? It's 3/4 of a year. So that's really sobering. It means that, you know, people are giving up. The underlying aspect of all of this is, unfortunately, despair is spreading.
Are they people in certain kinds of careers or jobs who are giving up looking for work?
I think there might be. We're seeing it varies, I think, from person to person, from industry to industry. But, you know, to take one of the industries where people have not given up, where people, you know, see it as a fallback, retail, right? So even when we see jumps in retail hiring, that often also has an asterisk, like it's seasonal or, you know, it's only certain kinds of business or it's short term or it's part time where they won't get benefits. So almost every industry that you look at right now has that kind of asterisk. The financial industry, of course, on which New York State depends in New York City for its tax revenue, is going to be facing a brutal year of layoffs. And I don't know if that's probably not reflected yet in these numbers, but, you know, we're going to see that over time, and it's going to hit our state hard.
Heidi Moore from Marketplace. And all right, from the Labor Department to the Politics Department.
There's no reason folks should suffer even more than they already are from the president's failure to turn this jobs crisis around. But there's also no reason we should pay for that relief by raising taxes on the very employers we're counting on to help jolt this economy back to life.
Republicans are uninterested in going after these high-income earners. As usual, the only real target of this Republican meat axe is the American middle class.
Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, and Harry Reid, the Democratic leader in the Senate. And wait a minute. That's the Marketplace bad news music. Well, it seems like it's always political stormy weather, Heidi. These days, no matter what the markets are doing, and when the adventures of Super Committee ended in failure last week, it set the stage for this new battle in Washington. A cut in the payroll tax is set to expire at the end of the year, and that's what McConnell and Reid were arguing about there. What's at stake?
Sure. Well, this payroll tax cut, you may not have thought about it because you've already experienced it for the past 2 years in your paycheck. President Obama brought it in with the stimulus in 2009, and basically it gives you back, you know, $1,000 or something like that, $1,500 if you make, say, $50,000. And, you know, that's helpful. It's based on the theory that if you put more money in people's pockets in a recession, you'll help stimulate demand. They'll go out and they'll spend it. But in fact, there are some problems with this idea. Number one is that the payroll tax that we're looking tax cut that we're looking at now doesn't just apply to the middle class like the previous ones did. It will apply to everybody. And as we know, those high earners are not going to care if they have an extra $1,000, $2,000 in their pockets. They're probably just going to stuff it in the bank. So that won't stimulate demand. And then the middle class, who can use that money, will probably use it to pay down their debt. Right. Or they will save it as well, because God knows everyone needs a nest egg, even though our savings rate is practically zero. So and then the other part of this payroll tax cut that's problematic is that it's supposed to be the very first one that offers a subsidy to employers. So if you're a small business, this will give you back some money when you hire somebody. Right. Tax money. And if you hire somebody, this is how one expert explained it to me, and I thought he said it well. If you are hiring somebody and you're paying them $40,000 a year and you're getting back $2,000, that doesn't really defray your costs all that much. So it's questionable whether that will help, especially considering that this was tried before in the Carter administration and only 6% of businesses actually used that money, you know, actually took advantage of the tax cut. So those are the problems. Now, the thing is, you know, we're deep into this recession, and all the experts I talked to said the same thing. Something is better than nothing. And Congress keeps forgetting this in every single debate this year. You know, they'd rather have gridlock than a decision of any sort. And I think that's really sad for the economy.
It sounds like both parties want to keep this payroll tax cut, but Democrats want to pay for it by taxing the wealthy. Republicans want to pay for it by cutting the federal workforce and freezing their pay. Both bills got voted down in the Senate last night. That's the issue, right?
That's part of the issue. And then there's also a really interesting issue of how this gets paid for, right? So part of this, if you reduce the payroll tax, what does that do? That shrinks the Social Security Trust Fund, right? So then you have to think ahead, because if you're paying less in payroll taxes, you're putting less into Social Security. So we'll have to think ahead, too, about the impact of this payroll tax cut across both parties, what that does for, you know, people who are aging and people who are collecting on Social Security. As we know, there are going to be more of those people.
Some political analysts are saying last night's stuckness in the Senate could actually clear the way for a compromise on this by the end of the month, when these extended unemployment benefits expire and that payroll tax cut expires. How does being deadlocked clear the way for becoming undeadlocked? Is that at all clear to you?
No, it doesn't at all. And, you know, do you like The Godfather?
Yeah, as a movie.
Yeah, right.
Maybe
I love that
as
movie.
A person. Go ahead.
Exactly. Right. And there's a line in one of The Godfather movies where they say somebody doesn't want to sign over all of their belongings. And they tell him either your brains or your signature will be on this contract. And that is the only way that Congress seems to do business. They feel the luxury of being deadlocked and procrastinating until the very last minute when it's evident that it's going to have some dire consequences.
But maybe the question is, whose brains? And I don't know how much you want to jump from being an economics reporter to being a political analyst, but the New York Times analyzes this today by saying polls show that concern about inequality in America is getting bigger than concern about big government in America. That's one reason the Democrats keep pushing for tax hikes on the wealthy. So if those polls are true, it portends well for the Democrats in 2012. And it also means Occupy Wall Street has been a success at shaping public opinion.
Well, I think there's no question at this point that Occupy Wall Street has entered the media stream in a way that has at least spurred some conversation, right? I mean, if you think back 2, 3, 4 years ago, you know, before the financial crisis, you know, people weren't asking whether capitalism, the way it works, is the way to do things, right? People are asking that now, and it's because partly of the financial crisis, but also partially because there's this movement where they can meet with like-minded people. And even if they don't agree, it does raise these questions and you do have this debate. It's unclear yet, you know, what the actual impact of the movement is on public opinion. But certainly a lot of, you know, people in finance are thinking about it and are talking about it. And, you know, they see its appeal to a lot of people and they're worried about that because they also think there's a place for capitalism done right. Of course, done right is a very big part of this, what we have to figure out.
Right. And so, that could be the political analysis to go with of Occupy so far, which is that people say, well, I don't like those, you know, dirty people in the park or something like that. But they have a point about this rising inequality, and we'll see where that leads people in terms of the election year. My guest, Heidi Moore, the New York Bureau Chief for the Public Radio Program Marketplace. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. I also want to talk about the Europe crisis, including why Ben Bernanke got the U.S. knee-deep into the euro mess this week. But some people are calling in with questions about this unemployment rate, the fact that the unemployment rate came down substantially in November, according to the numbers just released this morning, down to 8.6%, while the number of jobs created really wasn't that high. And one of them is Amy in Manhattan. Hi, Amy. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Heidi. One thing I've heard before that about how people the unemployment rate doesn't reflect the people who have stopped looking for work. What I have never heard is about freelancers like me, who, and in many cases, aren't eligible for employment in the first place, but sometimes are. For example, I worked for one of my clients, took me on part time. And that made me eligible for unemployment when that was over. And but I'm still freelancing. For example, last week I didn't have any work. This week I've had enough work that I can't claim for the week. And it can be anywhere in between. So are there any statistics being kept that reflect that?
That's a good question. How are freelancers like Amy counted in the unemployment rate?
Yeah, they're not counted in the unemployment rate, but you can look for, you know, different kinds of statistics. There are measures of underemployment, which I think is the big problem facing the country. And it includes, you know, we've moved into this service economy, into this gig economy, as people have called it. And, you know, there are a lot of freelancers. I used to freelance myself. And it is a kind of, we treat it as a shadow economy, but it's not, right? It is, a lot of people need some flexibility in their work hours and do this. So what you want to look for, if you're trying to get a picture of that, is how underemployment is rising. And underemployment is rising very much indeed. I mean, those numbers are not encouraging, and arguably they may even have a far bigger impact than what we see in the employment numbers.
Charlie in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Charlie.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment with regards to people who stop looking for work. And whether or not they should be counted. My opinion on that is that they really should not be counted, expressly because they had the option to stop looking for work. The people who have given up looking for work, they're people who have made the choice to stay home with their kids, to go back to grad school, to do something other than actively seek a job. In some cases, it's people who have decided to start a business. For most people who are unemployed, that simply isn't an option. You simply can't, you know, decide to go back to school or what have you. And for those who do have that option, I think not counting them in the workforce and having them out of the workforce for those that really don't have another option is probably a good thing.
Maybe, except that could be too optimistic a spin on the people choosing not to look for work. Like, it's just
Have you ever known someone who chose to be a hobo? I mean, honestly.
Well, Heidi, are there good data on this that you can reflect? You were talking about people who, out of despair, after looking for 99 weeks or more, just kind of give up. That's different from somebody who chooses to go back to grad school or chooses a lifestyle of being a stay-at-home parent.
Yeah, it could well be. And here's the way that I would put it. Number one, I think the big sort of thing to say here is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics should measure that. They should measure, you know, how much of their statistics of people dropping out are due to, you know, people seeking other kinds of employment or grad school or whatever.
And they
don't
do it that sophisticatedly, because Charlie makes a good point about, you know, some categories of people who aren't currently looking for work, who may have been previously working. The Labor Department can't tell us what percent of those giving up looking for work those folks are.
Not as far as I know. I mean, the numbers with unemployment just aren't that granular, unfortunately. You're dealing with millions of people, of course. And so there are some things that they might just sacrifice on, revealing publicly. But the point that I would make, you know, is that we should reserve judgment because we don't have, you know, facts to back us up on this idea. So, you know, if you have maybe, you know, 100,000 people out of work, you know, 800,000 people out of work, you know, maybe you can argue that they had all these other options and they decided to take them. When you have 2 million people out of work for 99 weeks or more, it's really hard to argue that that's moral weakness. You know, that looks like a trend, a demographic trend.
From our comments page, Janet from Manhattan writes, isn't the latest unemployment rate of 8.6% also influenced by holiday jobs, which will end next month? Is that true? Is this just temp workers being taken on at Walmart?
Part of it might be. It's hard to tell right now. That could be part of it. Generally, seasonal hiring starts in November. So we haven't, you know, completely sort of covered all of the ground of seasonal hiring, because more will be hired next month as well. So we'll have to wait and see.
All right. Let me spend our last couple of minutes talking about the euro crisis. The Dow surged 500 points on Wednesday when central banks outside the eurozone intervened to help the continent, the U.S., Japan, England, and Canada. But there are plenty of skeptics, Heidi, who say the rally was unwarranted. So with a couple of days now to sober up, what does it look like these central banks did, and what effect might it actually have on avoiding catastrophe?
Sure, these poor central banks, right? So they do this every so often. And I say every so often because it only applies to these crisis situations. Whenever you have a financial crisis, what happens is debt dries up, right? People don't want to lend to each other. They don't trust each other as much, which maybe you and I can get by on what we have. But if you're a bank and you borrow every single day just to keep going and you're dealing in debt, that is a huge risk. And so in 2007, when the banks were at risk, the European Central Bank and the Fed came in and they just injected, you know, billions of dollars into the economy to help banks move money around. And that's what the European Central Banks did this week as well. My metaphor for it is kind of like a gas tank, right? So a lot of these European central banks European banks are kind of running out of gas, and they're not doing very well. They need something to keep going because nobody will give them any gas. They just don't have the right money for it. No one wants their euros. So the Fed and the European Central Bank came in and they said, we'll give you a shot of premium unleaded gas, which is our dollars. And that's what they did. And of course, this has a limited effectiveness. It only works for a little while, just until the panic ends. And it doesn't stop, you know, a complete run on the banks forever. But it does buy us some time, and it was good that they did that because I think things were getting pretty dire this week.
Real quick, check this out if you didn't already. The Wall Street Journal headline on Europe this morning is, a Euro crisis deal emerges. The New York Times headline is, German inflation fears stall steps in debt crisis. Those things can't both be true, can they?
No, from the financial crisis movie Rashomon, right? Things are dire, and they're still trying to work out a treaty. If I had to take a vote on those two headlines, not on the two papers, but just on the two headlines, I'd go with the Times.
From her own independent news organization, not taking a position on the competing business media, Heidi Moore, New York Bureau Chief for Marketplace. Thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, WNYC's Andrea Bernstein from Transportation Nation joins us. As some of you in Rockland County know, the final Metro North line to return to the rails finally got back on track after Hurricane Irene this week. We will ask the larger question, is mass transit around here in general ready for a global warming era? More things like this. Stay with us.